Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest exciting adventure, the latest what's going on out there from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the indomitable. Can't really pronounce that word, actually. Yes, I never know whether the N or the M. Honestly, I never know whether the N or the M comes first. Is it indomitable or indomitable?
Indomitable.
Yeah, okay, indomitable. That's great. Thanks very much indeed, Miss Jones. I knew I could rely on you to straighten up my diction in the English language. And, of course, folks, she has already introduced herself, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. How are you this fine day, Miss Jones?
Yeah, but things are calming down a bit now. They've been a bit blown away. You've nearly taken off a few times, I think. I went out to post a letter on the day the storm really kicked in. And yeah, that was a big mistake. I shouldn't have done that. You know, it's dangerous just to go outside the door, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I had a much more shocking experience, right? And I know the storms. Sorry, what are you laughing at?
No, it's just there was a pause, a pregnant pause.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, what I was going to say, well, I know the storms have gone now, but it's still pretty windy as I speak. You know, I can still, I tell you one great thing that I'm really, really happy about. My first of the year daffodils didn't get blown down. I knew the winds were coming, so I put protectors around them. You see what I mean? And I thought, I'll be heartbroken if my daffodils go, but they haven't. They've stayed. And I put out a picture of them. You may have seen it. They're lovely. My daffodils in the garden, they really brighten up my day. You know, I get up, I walk through the apartment, I walk down the hall and through the kitchen and then look out onto the garden. And to see all those daffodils, you know, what was the Wordsworth poem? I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on a high or vale and hill when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of something daffodils along the lake beneath the trees, they fluttered gaily in the breeze. Yes, I love that poem.
I loved it when you put the quotation on Twitter as well. It's a nice bit of words with culture.
Yes, exactly.
For a windy day.
Yes.
Yeah. I tell you what my favorite flowers of this time of year are. And there's even a word for people who love them. Have you heard of a galanthophile?
Yes.
Have you ever come across that
one? No, I haven't. That sounds like that sounds a bit mischievous, that, eh?
It sounds like it's something out of Doctor Who, doesn't it? Like somebody from Gallifrey or something, which is Doctor Who's planet.
Yes,
a galanthophile is a person who loves or who collects different types of snowdrops. And, of course, snowdrops, they look like quite innocent little flowers, don't they, growing in the hedgerows and so on.
Yeah.
But there are many, many varieties of these. And I didn't know this. The Greek name for this flower is actually Galanthus, hence the name. And it means milk flower, which I think is such a lovely little phrase.
Oh, it certainly is. Yeah, milk flower. I love to see snowdrops poking out through the snow, if you see what I mean. I mean, I know they don't poke out through the snow because they're there and then the snow falls around them. But we get so little snow these days. But when I was a kid and we grew up in the north of England, you got snow every year and used to love seeing the snowdrops and all that kind of stuff. But there we are. No, what happened to me was I was doing breakfast television. And great thing about doing breakfast TV is the lovely TV studios always give you a car afterwards to take you wherever you want, really. You know, some people get a car to take them home to places like Bournemouth or something. I couldn't be bothered getting in their car for that length of time. So all I really need to do is get across London, you know.
So
I'd much prefer to get a train, you know, than sit in a car. But anyway, I had to get over to the Albert Embankment to go to another studio where I was filming a sort of video podcast in a made-up bar. You know, the studio had been turned into a bar for a football video promo. And the car dropped me at the wrong place, but I didn't realise that until I got out and the car had gone. And the wind was so strong that I thought, this is dangerous. I thought, this is definitely dangerous. So I grabbed onto a lamppost, okay? And I inched my way down Albert Embankment, a lamppost at a time. I'm not joking, right? Until I was standing on the other side of the road from Geoffrey Archer's penthouse apartment on the Albert Embankment. And it's an amazing apartment. It's right at the top of, I think it's a tower. I won't tell people what the name of the tower is because obviously it reveals Geoffrey Archer's address. But it's a big tower on the banks of the River Thames. He's got the top two floors and he's got views on all four sides. I've been there. He used to have Christmas parties, which were called Shepherd's Pie and Champagne Parties.
Exactly. I went to one of them.
Yeah. Oh, right. There you go. So you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? Anyway,
I
let go of the lamppost to walk to the next lamppost and an even greater gust blew up and bang, I was bowled over like a piece of, what's that stuff that blows across the street in Westerns, you know what I mean?
Tumbleweed.
You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
Tumbleweed.
Tumbleweed, well done, yeah. So I was bouncing down the pavement like a bit of tumbleweed. Honestly, it was terrifying. And considering I nearly got knocked, well, I did get knocked down by a car about a month ago, I suddenly thought, you know, me and the pavements are starting to have a very intimate relationship, you know. And I got up and I must have had shock on my face because I got up and grabbed a pillar of a building, actually. And some guy came out and said, are you all right? And all this kind of stuff. So it was pretty damn terrifying. I've never experienced winds like that. And like you, I've been all over the world.
I think you need to be a bit more careful out there, Mr. Parry, because this is twice now this has happened in the period of about 10 days.
Yeah.
They say that these things come in threes, so you need to really watch your step now.
Yes, I think you're perhaps right. Anyway, the news is that Macca's going to Glastonbury. Now, I bet you've been to Glastonbury a million times. I've never been to Glastonbury. But also, Miss Jones, without, you know, putting you on the spot, you've also told me you're not sure whether Macca's, you know, voice would last a whole sort of Glastonbury, well, not a Glastonbury set, but any set at all these days.
Well, I have to disagree with you there on both accounts. First of all, I've never been to Glastonbury because when I was a rock writer, pop writer on Fleet Street back in the 80s, early 90s, rock festivals were not yet a thing. You know, there were the Isle of Wight Festival. My friend Joel Giddings had revived it. Glastonbury was quite a small, insignificant thing. The Reading Festival was a bigger deal back in those days. But I was never a festival girl. And it wasn't as it is today that festivals are a big industry. That hadn't happened yet. So at this stage in the game, the last place you're going to get me is Glastonbury Festival. It's actually horrible. My daughter goes to it and she says, you know, because the toilets are so far away and the crowds are so packed in front of those stages, people don't bother going to the toilet. Yeah. They just do it where they stand. And so it's all a bit of a cesspit and it's not my idea of fun. No, well, that's how it is.
No,
the second thing, I've never actually said that Macca's voice is not up to it, but he is 80 years old. His voice has aged. Of course it has. It was always going to. Everybody's voice ages and deepens as time ticks on. He really does rely on his session musicians to back up his vocals when he gives live performances. But at this stage in the game, I would say this. It's not about what he sounds like. Okay, you're going to see Paul McCartney at Glastonbury to experience Macca and the nostalgia and the memories and a bit of the Beatles rather than going to hear the quality of his voice. If you want to hear the quality of his voice, dig out the old records, the old Beatles, the old Wings, the old solo stuff, and really relish the way he once sounded. But don't expect to get a brilliant Paul McCartney voice when he's 80 years old.
I think you summed it up in one, absolutely. Just being in the presence of a Beatle, just being in the presence of Paul McCartney would do it for me. But like you, I wouldn't dream of going to a festival. The only time I would go is if somebody offered to lend me a, you know, a big, what do you call it, you know, like camper van type thing, but bigger than that.
A Winnebago. Yeah, the Winnebago.
What's it called? Winnebago.
A Winnebago.
Well done, a Winnebago, and it had a shower. Yes, that's right. And had a shower and all that kind of stuff. That would be excellent. But anyway, there we go. Now then, Miss Jones, we have many different sort of roles in life, in our professions, all the sort of things you do and I do. Delighted to say that this week I was employed to promote a beer. How about that?
I think that was amazing. I saw the pictures. You look very at home behind the bar there.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. Now, it's an amazing story behind this because the beer was called Lucan Ale and it was launched and I had the very first pint ever. It's a new beer. It's newly brewed. It's newly labelled. And it was in a pub called the Plumber's Arms, which is in Lower Belgravia Street. Sounds very posh, doesn't it? Yeah. Very near to Victoria Station. And all I had to do was drink a few pints and talk to a few people, all that kind of stuff. Very nice indeed. It's a Green King pub, I think. But the reason it's called the Lucan Ale is because the pub I'm talking about was the pub where Lord Lucan's wife, that's Lady Lucan, ran in there, I think it was about 40 years ago now, and screamed that he was trying to kill her. And Lord Lucan had already clubbed the nanny to death by then. And the thinking all these years on has been that he meant to kill his wife, but killed the nanny by mistake in the darkened basement, hit her with a piece of lead piping. The wife fled the house. Lucan was never seen again. And so this pub, which is about, I think it's about 12 doors away from the house where they lived in Lower Belgravia Street, has now become like the Lucan Museum. You know, and there's all pictures on the walls of Lucan and details of the case and all that kind of stuff. And people come from all over the world. It's not a particularly big pub. It's quite a small pub, but people come from America and Australia just to see the Lucan pub. And so they've now made their own Lucan Ale. So a bit of history going on there.
I tell you who would have really loved that pub. Yeah. Do you remember Garth Gibbs?
Yes, I do. He was a South African, worked for the Daily Mirror.
Yes, and he made his life's work not finding Lord Lucan in every glamorous corner of the world on lavish expenses.
Yes.
And when he died in 2011, he was 75. He was a great guy, a real character. He said that never finding Lord Lucan was his most spectacular success because it gave him the opportunity to swan around the world, spending his newspaper's money and having the life of Riley. Yeah. What a great job.
You're absolutely right. He said about once a year, he'd sidle up to the news desk, wouldn't he, and said, you know, I've had a tip-off, Lucan, in Africa. Right, off you go. I've had a tip-off, Lucan, South America. Off you go. I've had a tip-off, Lucan, Gold Coast, Australia. Get going. Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I worked with Garth on a few, and he was a great sort of sociologist in his dealings with the news desk, whereas most people sort of, you know, just take what the news desk say and act on their orders. Garth would do things like he'd tell them some ridiculous story, right, down the phone, if we were on a job somewhere in a, you know, the remote wilds of where. And then he'd tell them this ridiculous story as to why he had to stay another 2 days, you know, in some location like the Bahamas or something. And then he'd hold the phone away from his ear and pretend he was talking to a colleague by putting his hand over the phone and say, these bastards don't believe me. They don't know what they're doing, do they? Sitting in their, you know, their ivory towers in London. I'm the guy here who's working myself to death and all this kind of stuff. And then he put the phone back to his ear and they say, oh, all right, Garth, yeah, you better stay a couple of days more.
Yeah, he had style, didn't he?
He did.
And he played them absolutely at their own game. Yeah. And he got away with it. Wherever he fancied going on holiday with his wife or his girlfriend at that point, he would just decide that there'd been a sighting of Lord Lucan. I think it's a wonderful wheeze.
Yes, I think it's absolutely fantastic. Now, Miss Jones, I know you're not a huge TV fan, but I'm very excited because Peaky Blinders is coming back this weekend, actually. And once the first episode's been played, the rest of it is all there on iPlayer. I think it's about at least 6 episodes, might be 10. I shall watch it right the way through from start to finish. I may even stay up all night to watch it. I'm so thrilled. Peaky Blinders, for me, the greatest ever TV series, written by Stephen Knight, a man I've met many times. I tell you the interesting thing, Leslie Ann. Stephen Knight wrote every word that's ever been spoken in 6 series of 5 and another one to come, 6 series of the Peaky Blinders. He wrote every word. He put every word in. He devised every plot. Coronation Street and shows like that have a team of up to 20 writers who write between them. But Stephen wrote every word. He imagined it all. He created the plots and he wrote the dialogue. That is genius, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's on a J.K. Rowling kind of level, isn't it?
Yes.
To be honest,
Yes.
I haven't seen it because I know people who've watched it, including your good self,
Yeah.
and it's apparently quite violent. And that kind of television watching just upsets me. I can't sleep at night after watching
Yes.
something
Yes.
as violent as that.
Yes.
So no, I've avoided it. But there are TV programs that I watch and enjoy. I just haven't joined you on that
No,
one.
I know. That's true. Talking about landmarks, by the way, in the world of film and TV, the Godfather is this week celebrating 50 years since its release. Have you seen The Godfather?
No, I never
Are
have,
you
for
joking?
obvious reasons. No, for obvious reasons.
Good,
It's
good.
violent and sinister, isn't it?
Well, it is violent and sinister, but it's also a cinematic classic. I mean, it created a genre of film which is still with us half a century on.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But do you remember the film Scarface
Yes, I do.
with Al Pacino?
Yes.
I was taken to see that and it traumatized me for about 5 years.
You're joking.
No, there's a scene in that which I don't even want to say what it was, and it was so horrifying. I was nearly sick.
Now I know the scene you're talking about. It involves a chainsaw, doesn't it?
Yeah, don't.
No, all right, I'm
Horrible.
sorry, I'll stay away from that. But Al Pacino for me is the most mesmerizing actor I've ever seen. I think he excelled in Godfather 2, which was in my view better than even Godfather 1. And he was, of course, the lead role in Scarface that you're talking about, which we'll move on from because obviously, Miss Jones, you are a woman of sensitive senses.
Stop. Stop.
Yeah.
I'm a delicate fly.
Delicate flower, you could say that, yeah. Now then, can you tell me, please, about your friend Emily Attack? Because we already talked about Macca, and I didn't want to dwell too much on McCartney and all that. But this lady, Emily Attack, who I'd never heard of till I read something in one of the newspapers, is apparently, quite successful and all that. But she's also the third cousin to Paul McCartney and tells stories of great New Year's Eve parties at Macca's house in northwest London and complaining that she went to one where Michael Jackson had paid a visit to Paul's house but had just left, and she threw a paddy because she didn't meet Michael Jackson. And as her mother said at the time, you're related to one of the Beatles. You're in the Beatles' house at a New Year's Eve party, and you're moaning that you didn't see Michael Jackson. I mean, she has very high expectations in life, that lady.
Well, she does. She's absolutely beautiful, Emily. First of all, her surname is pronounced
No,
Atack.
Ata.
There's only one T in it.
Oh, okay.
I know both her parents. Her dad is a guitarist called Keith Atack, and her mother is Kate Robbins, who you probably remember from shows like Spitting
Yes, I
Image.
do.
She used to perform as Sarah Ferguson,
Yeah,
Fergie, and that
that's
kind of
right.
thing.
Yeah.
Very clever impersonator, Kate, and she's a good singer and pianist as well.
Yes.
And she is Paul's cousin, quite rightly. And her brother is Ted Robbins,
Right.
who you might remember from entertainment television years ago.
Right.
Emily was recently all over the papers because she was caught up in this romantic triangle with Jack
Yeah,
Grealish.
I don't get that, honestly. There's one particular newspaper which is pushing Jack Grealish as a great Romeo, and every week they seem to picture him with yet another new girl. And quite frankly, I think they've completely misjudged their readership. Nobody really cares that much about footballers' girlfriends, particularly, Jack Grealish is a great footballer. He's a nice lad and all that, but he's not Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also, the only footballers' wives we care about at the moment are Colleen
That's
Rooney and
right.
Becky
That's
Vardy, isn't
right.
it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But Emily, I mean, yes, first of all, New Year's Eve parties were so important to Paul McCartney. When he was a kid, his parents always had, or his auntie Jin always had a New Year's Eve party, and his dad would get on the piano and everybody would sing around the piano and so on. So New Year's Eve is really important to Paul. And yes, he did have New Year's Eve parties at his St. John's Wood house. Emily wouldn't have been born at that time
Right.
during the St. John's Wood years
Oh.
because she's only in her 20s now.
But he's still
So
got the
I think
house, hasn't
she.
he?
Yeah, he still has the house, but I don't think he has the parties there anymore because he lives mostly in America now. But she might just be recycling her mum's memories,
Sure,
I think.
yeah. Well, whatever,
She's a lovely girl, by the way. Absolutely
No,
love
she
her,
looks
Emily.
lovely. I mean, honestly, I think I've seen her looks lovely, but excuse me, there we go. Right, okay, now then, Douglas Bader, okay. You might think that's a strange subject for us to be talking about, but of course, researching all my journals as I do, I find out that Douglas Bader was born in this week 100 years ago, okay? And I thought, oh, that's really interesting, because he'd be about the same age as my dad now, who also fought in the Second World War. But anyway, Douglas Bader, just to refresh the memories of our younger listeners, was the legless Spitfire pilot. He lost his legs in a flying accident while he was training to be a pilot, but undeterred, he came out of hospital months later and went back to flying with two false legs. And was eventually shot down over France, captured and imprisoned in Germany in Colditz Castle, the you know, the famous prisoner of war camp for elite prisoners like him. So he's a national hero, and he became a squadron leader, DFC, all that kind of stuff. And I think he was knighted. I think it was Sir Douglas Bader. Yeah, he was. So anyway, when I was a very young reporter on the Daily Express, just arrived in London in Fleet Street after being transferred from Manchester, I went in on one Sunday morning and I couldn't believe there was nobody there. I went in at 7:30. Nobody even turned up till about 9:30 or 10 o'clock. You know what I mean? But I was keen as mustard. I don't know about you, Miss Jones, but, you know, I couldn't wait to get into work. Anyway, the phone rings on the news desk. But, of course, I was sitting at the reporter's desk and I thought, I wonder if I'm allowed to answer the news desk phone, right? Because, you know, you have this sort of power structure in newspapers and newspaper floors. Anyway, I thought I better had. So I went and answered the phone, and a woman was on the other end. She said, "Hello, is that the Daily Express?" I said, "Yes, it is the Daily Express." She said, "Oh, right." She said, "This is Lady Bader." I said, "Oh, hello." She said, "Yes, what's your name?" And I said, "Oh, it's Mike Parry." She said, "Oh, should I be talking to you?" I said, "Yes, you should." There was nobody else there.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
And she said, "I thought I'd give you a ring because I'm afraid to tell you that Dougie died last night." I said, "Oh," I said, "you know, well, you don't know what to say, do you? You know," I said, "oh dear," I said, that's shocking news." So, you know, I sort of grabbed a pen. I said, "What happened?" And she said, "Well, we were out in London, and I always drive, and we'd gone to the theatre, we came out, and we got in the car, and I was driving along Victoria Embankment. And I was talking to Dougie, but I realised he wasn't talking back to me. And I thought, I wonder if he's fallen asleep, you know. So I shook him, nothing happened. And I thought, oh dear, this isn't very good. So I drove to a hospital. I suppose that would have been the hospital on the banks of the river. I've forgotten what it's called now. You know, the one where...
The Thames is the river.
The Thames is the river, yeah. But Boris was taken to the one I'm talking about. It's near Downing Street.
St. Thomas's Hospital.
Well done. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And she said, and I got there and I went in and I found a nurse or a doctor or something. They came out and they listened to his chest and they said, "I'm afraid he's dead."
Why are you laughing? Why are we laughing?
No, this is an awful story. No, I'm not laughing at the fact that somebody died. It's just the way she related it, as though it was, you know, part of the theatre she'd been to last night. You know what I mean? She was remarkably balanced and controlled. And I thought, well, she doesn't really sound much like a grieving widow. But, you know, I suppose that they were made of better stock in those days. You know, these Spitfire pilots and their wives and all this kind of stuff. You know, although I think she...
Great scoop, by the way.
Oh, exactly. Because, you see, what happened next was amazing. So I said, "Yes, thank you very much." You know, I took it all down. I got her phone number. You know, I had the presence of mind to say, "Look, if we need to ring you back to get some more details, where can I find you?" She gave me the number and all that kind of stuff. Okay. It was absolutely amazing. So about 10 to 10, one of the news desk guys comes in, you know, and he starts effing and blinding about what a really quiet day it is. We've got nothing on, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do and all that. I said, "Well, I've got a story for you." He said, "Yeah, what is it?" I said, "Douglas Bader's died." He said, "What?" You know, he said, "How do you know?" I said, "I've just spoken to Lady Bader." He said, "What?" You know, and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, John Downing, who you remember, the photographer, right?
Yes.
Lived somewhere near her. in Berkshire or somewhere like that. You know what I mean? John lived in a big house out in the country somewhere. And before he left his wife and chapped up with a very young reporter in London.
Oh, don't they always?
Yeah.
It's so predictable.
It's exactly what happened in his 50s. You know, he suddenly sort of, you know, went bonkers, left his wife in their lovely home in the country, moved into a little flat in somewhere like, you know, I don't know, Victoria or something, with a woman 30 years his junior. But anyway, there you go. But anyway, so they said to me, get over to John Downing's. So I drove out to John, parked my car there, and we both went to Lady Barder's home and spent an hour and a half, 2 hours talking to her. And nobody else had picked up the story by this time. You know, it was kind of mid-afternoon on Sunday. And then we got a dispatch rider to come out and get the films. John was amazing. All he did was circle around Lady Barder as I was talking to her. And he just said to her, forget I'm even here. And at one stage, he was lying on the floor looking upwards through his lens and all this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? It's amazing stuff. He didn't just walk in and take a picture and walk out. And then the films went back into London. I filed my copy over the phone, went back to John's and had a celebratory few glasses of wine. And we didn't get away with it altogether because the news started breaking about 5 o'clock in the evening. But we had a huge lead on everybody else, you know, with the pictures and the full talk and all that kind of stuff. So it was one of my, as you say, one of my great scoops, purely from the fact I like getting into the office early.
Wonderful story, that.
Thank you.
And I can sort of add to that a little bit.
Oh, yes.
Because my father-in-law, my ex-father-in-law, actually, oh, yeah, the late Michael Shine,
oh, yeah,
was also an RAF squadron leader, and he also lost both legs.
Wow.
Not in the same way that Douglas Bardair had lost his in serving,
yeah,
during, you know, in, what would they call, well, it? What would be, what's the expression?
Well, it's in action, but he wasn't actually
in action.
In action. He was training on a, what you call a biplane. You know, those old-fashioned planes with two wings.
Yes.
And he tried to do a loop-the-loop, Douglas Bardair, to show off in front of other aviators, for want a better word. And he completely mistimed it and smashed into the ground.
Well, Michael didn't lose his legs training or in action,
right,
but he basically smoked himself legless.
Oh, right.
He was a smoking addict,
yeah,
and his circulation started to pack up. And the first signs were the fact that the fingertips went blue. And so apparently did his toes, although I didn't see them.
Yeah.
And he was warned by his specialist that if he didn't stop smoking,
yeah,
he would start to lose his extremities, his limbs,
yeah,
his well, obviously his hands,
yes,
his feet, that kind of thing.
Yes.
And he made the conscious decision to carry on smoking regardless.
Golly.
And the first amputation he had was up to the knee.
Mm.
So he had a left leg that was just half a leg.
Yeah.
And at that stage,
half
he
a
had
leg.
A prosthetic.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a prosthetic leg. And he carried on,
yeah,
driving up from Wiltshire,
yeah,
to visit us in London and so on.
Yeah.
And then they had to take the rest of that leg up to the groin.
Golly.
So he had to stop driving at that point. Yeah. And then the same process happened with the other leg.
Yeah.
And he ended up, it was horrifying, really.
Yeah.
He was half a person. So he stopped at the groin.
Golly.
And he used to go around in a wheelchair and one of those mechanised, you know, trolleys that you see people driving around the street.
Well, did they have them in those days?
Yeah, they. It's quite recent. This.
Oh, I see.
It's not very long ago.
Oh, I see.
And he had one of those. He used to go and do his shopping and so on. Mm. But he was half a person.
Golly.
So he stopped at the groin. He stopped at his bottom and there was nothing there on to the ground. And it was a horribly sad way to see somebody disintegrate.
Oh, golly.
And if I always said to the kids, if ever you think of taking up smoking, think of Grandpa and just don't bother.
Think again, absolutely. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Just a short commercial break there, folks. But I want to get back to that story, Leslie, and you've just told about losing legs, because I can add to that as well. We keep adding to each other's stories. The most famous footballer in English history is Dixie Dean, because he scored 350-odd goals for Everton and England during his career, including 60 in one season, which has never been bettered. George Campbell scored 59 for Middlesbrough in 1927, and Dixie, I think, in 1928, scored 60, which is an amazing sort of feat for obvious reasons. Now, believe it or not, Dixie Dean lost a leg through smoking. How about that? You know, one of the greatest footballers ever. And exactly the same,
yeah,
thing happened. He lost a leg and they used to have to wheel him to Everton in a wheelchair, obviously. It was a long time ago. And he died of a heart attack at Goodison Park at half time during an Everton Liverpool game, and his illness, his heart deterioration, was brought on by smoking. So that is a salutary lesson to any young person who wants to take up smoking. You are absolutely right.
And here's another connection, because my grandfather, Emlyn Jones, who was known as a player as Mickey Jones, played on the same Everton side as Dixie Jones.
Utterly unbelievable, isn't it, eh? Utterly unbelievable, the way all those things connect together. Now, the other day, I was coming away from another job. I was in a car, Miss Jones, and I came around Colmore Circus. And that's, of course, where the mighty mirror building used to be in the days when your dad worked there, okay, Ken Jones?
What did you call it?
Colmore Circus, wasn't it?
I always thought it was Hoban Circus.
Hoban Circus, you're right. Colmore Circus is another one around there somewhere. It's the end of Shoe Lane, isn't it? End of Shoe Lane, Hoban Circus, you're absolutely right. And, I mean, to say the mirror building was magnificent is to understate it. It was a huge glass palace. It had mirror written all over the front, Sunday Mirror, Daily Mirror, Sunday People. And I used to go in there on Saturdays. I used to do a shift on a Saturday, okay? I worked for the Birmingham Evening Mail in the London office, but to make up my money, I got paid as much on a Saturday working for the Mirror as I got paid for the rest of the week working for the Birmingham Mail. And in those days, you could literally do the Donald Duck Mickey Mouse thing. You went up to the pay desk at the end of your shift at about 8 o'clock in the evening or something like that, and you put the form in that the news editor had given you, and you, when it said write your name, you would write Donald Duck or Mickey Mouse or anything you liked, Superman. It didn't matter. It was the days when, you know, unions ruled in Fleet Street, and you took it cash in hand, didn't pay any tax, and had a great night out in London. But anyway, point of my story is, I remember those days, and I thought, golly, you know, it must have been magnificent to have walked in and out of that building. But what concerns me these days is that sports reporters, and of course your father was one of the most famous of all time, seem to have a view on everything. And I think it's because of social media. And they all seem to have a social conscience. And they're all, you know, making arguments for and against, and they have a point of view on this. And I don't really want sports reporters to start talking about anything except sport. And when they get involved in, you know, transgender issues and all this kind of stuff, I think it's wrong. Did your dad used to? Because I've always had the impression that anybody who worked for the Mirror, and I've had lots of friends over the years who have worked for the Mirror, generally speaking, had the same sort of political beliefs that the Mirror had, in the same way that I always had the same political beliefs that the Daily Express had. How did your dad cope with it?
Dad always maintained that sport is an antidote to politics, or should be.
Right.
Having said that, I know that he would agree with me on this. He's not here to ask. Yeah. But I do think that football needs to wake up, drop the Russian sponsorships and the investments, and pull out of competitions involving Russia. UEFA needs to stop Russia, strip Russia of the Champions League final in St. Petersburg in May, as Boris has been saying. And I think we need to boycott Russia until this Ukraine war is quelled.
Right, okay. Boycott Russia until no, I can't disagree with that. I think we've got to I totally agree with you there. We've got to really, really get hard on them. We can't hit them militarily, because that would, you know, be so dangerous and put the world on a war footing, which we don't want to do. But I totally agree with you. Get rid of all that money in London. And if, I mean, the one thing Mr. Putin has to be very, very careful about is keeping his oligarchs happy. There's 50 of them. They're all billionaires. We start clamping down on their money, he's in trouble, and I wouldn't mind seeing him run into problems. Listen, we talked about Emily Attack, your friend there.
Emily Attack. How many times?
Emily Attack. Thanks for introducing me. But the other guy, it shocked me the other day to learn that a lad called Jamal Edwards has died, and I wasn't very aware of him whilst he was alive. God rest his soul. I think he died at the very young age of 32. But then I saw all the profiles of him, and what an amazing young man. He won an MBE at the age of 24 for working, you know, against racism and promoting sort of industries for young children and record labels and everything. Seems like an amazing guy, but I'd never really heard much about him because he was a rapper and I don't like rap music.
Yeah, he's big among the kids. My children were all very upset at his death. We don't really know what happened. Apparently, he had a heart attack at his mother's house. But, I mean, that must have been some sort of congenital defect
Yeah.
that he didn't know
Yeah,
about or
maybe.
something. But he was instrumental in building the careers of people like Jesse J, Rita Ora, Dave, and so on. And he was friends with William and Harry.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. He got an MBE very early on. His mother is one of the Loose Women presenters,
Oh, that's right. Yeah, of course.
Brenda.
Yes.
I think she was a voice contestant at some point.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, I never met him, but from the outpourings of
Yeah.
grief, he seems to have left a very large hole, and may he rest in
Yeah,
peace.
absolutely. It's a shocking thing, isn't it? You know, young man, you're right about
Yeah.
the congenital heart condition. I didn't know that I had a congenital heart condition until I went to the European Championships in Lisbon in 2004 and literally nearly died because I got up one morning and I couldn't get up. I mean, I couldn't stay up, you know what I mean? And I couldn't breathe, and I thought, it's all a bit funny. And I thought I'd had too much to drink the night before, but it got worse and worse and worse. In the end, I ended up being flown back in an air ambulance. I had acute heart failure. And for quite a long time afterwards, the doctors tried to find out what had caused it, and they eventually came to the conclusion, after finding my father's medical records, which they unearthed from somewhere, that I'd inherited it from my dad. But he didn't know he had it, and he died of it at the age of 58.
Oh God, that's so
Yeah.
sad. But look, I mean, you've outlived your father, God rest his soul, and you're still going.
Yeah.
You're doing all the right things. You watch your weight, you eat properly,
That's right.
you
Drink loads.
keep a lid on it drink wise.
Yeah.
I have not seen you legless for years.
Well,
So I think you're doing okay,
don't
Mike,
worry.
you
I do
know.
it in the shadows these days.
Oh dear.
So to
Well,
speak.
keep a lid on
People
it.
in it. That's right. Now, listen. I saw a program. I'm sorry, Miss Jones. That sounded like an instruction, didn't it? I meant to our millions of listeners. Listen up here, folks. Yeah, I saw a fantastic doco the other night. I'm a bit like you now these days. I don't really turn on the telly and watch things that are scheduled. I kind of wait till I've got a bit of time, and then, you know, the television facility is so good these days. You can get anything at any time, can't you? So I saw Brian Wilson, The Long Promised Road. Okay. And it was an incredible documentary about Brian Wilson. And look, you and I go on and on about the Beatles, and I say that without apology because I like going on and on about the Beatles because you know, one of the most important factors in my life. But I have to say, Brian Wilson comes very close to the word I would call genius in musician for the songs he's written and the way he did it. And he's an incredible story. He was literally driven mad by his own genius.
Yeah, and that's not unusual in the world of rock and roll. I think that we've talked about this before, all rock stars are damaged and dysfunctional in some way. It's the reason why they become rock musicians. And some are more extreme than others. Some of them hide it very well, but you can just tell from the outpourings in the songs. They are so raw and they encapsulate our own emotions and our feelings about feelings that we don't really have the capacity to explore. But these people are fearless and they go there in ways that we can't, which is why we relate to the songs, to the music so deeply.
Yes. Yeah. No. I totally agree with you. I think Paul McCartney. How can we always come back to Paul McCartney? Third time now in this podcast.
Funny, isn't
Yeah,
it?
it is.
Yeah.
But apparently, his favourite ever song was, and what was it? God Only Knows.
God only knows,
What's
yeah.
the first line of that? If you should ever leave me, life would go on, girl, believe me. Da 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 da. So what good would living do me?
Oh, very
Yeah.
good. Nice high
Yeah,
note
that's
there.
right. God only knows where I'd be without you. And that apparently is Macca's favourite song. And you can't really argue with that, can you?
Well, no, and of course the Beatles were massive fans of the Beach
Yeah.
Boys, and there was some rivalry there at a certain point. You know, they were trying to outdo each other
Sorry.
with their albums and so
Yeah.
on. And back in the USSR was their sort of the Beatles kind of send up of California
That's right.
Girls, if I
Yeah. Yeah,
remember.
that's right. Yeah. Yeah, the California girls, East Coast girls are hip. I really love the clothes they wear. And the back in the USSR, all the way from, the paperback was on my knee. Boy, it was a dreadful flight. Yeah, I can remember some of the words, but only a few.
And the Ukraine girls really
That's
knocked me out. I mean, there's a line for right now.
It certainly is. You're absolutely right. The Ukraine girls really knocked me out. Let's hope nobody gets knocked out in the Ukraine. It doesn't escalate and get any worse. Now, Miss Jones, of course, you have rubbed shoulders with celebrities for decades, literally. And I was very sorry to see that Kate Moss's little sister, I think her name is Lottie, seems to have succumbed to, you know, the temptations of stardom. The problem with poor little Lottie is that she's not actually a star in her own right, is she? She lives in the shadow of a massively famous sister, Kate Moss, probably one of the world's most famous models ever. And she must have had a hard life in that respect, I imagine.
Yeah, I feel this is a bit of a dangerous area too. We've got Beckham syndrome going on here.
Right.
Somebody trying to be something that they're not, which we talked about last time,
yes,
didn't we? But, you know, the trouble is she's become a drug addict, little Lottie, who I think is 19.
Right.
And the way it's being reported, I feel that it's being projected as cool and edgy. And this is a very dangerous influence,
yeah,
on impressionable young people.
Yeah.
Because once again, they're seeing the relative of somebody who's rich and famous,
mm,
and thinking, well, she's doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give it a go.
Yeah. Yeah, well, as you quite rightly say, talking about people who are famous, by the way, poor old Elton John suffered a bit of a nightmare. His private plane accounted, well, I shouldn't be laughing, should I? It's not very funny, is it, really, to be in an aeroplane that suddenly gets an engine failure at 10,000 feet, but then comes down to earth. And I noticed, and we've talked about this again in recent podcasts, I noticed it was while he was travelling around on his farewell tour. I mean, you know, I shouldn't be laughing. I'm not laughing. It's very serious. But that really could have been a farewell, couldn't it, if the plane had actually broken down and crashed out the air. Not that I wanted to or anything like that, you know what I mean? But it did remind me, so many stars of the past have lost their lives in air crashes, like Buddy Holly, yeah?
Yeah, and Patsy Cline went down in a plane, didn't she?
Yeah,
obviously, the Big Bopper went down in the same plane that,
yeah,
killed,
yeah,
Richie Valens, I think, was on
that's
that
right
plane.
You're
as
absolutely
well,
right.
But Paul Gambaccini told me an amazing story. Do you remember when John Lennon went on stage at Madison Square Garden during an Elton John concert?
Yes, I do.
I think it was 1974, and it was a surprise appearance.
Yes, I remember.
He hadn't performed for years.
Yes.
And Elton asked him to come on stage and do a couple of numbers. And so John flew up to Boston, to the Boston Garden,
yes,
to catch Elton's show ahead of the Madison Square Garden outing, just so he could get a feel for the live show. And because,
yeah,
he was terrified. He hadn't performed for many years.
Oh, really? Really?
Yes, and he yeah, just wanted to get a feel for Elton's show.
Right.
On the way back to New York, the plane got caught up in a terrible storm,
mm-hmm,
and it was really touch and go.
Yeah.
And Paul Gambaccini was sitting next to Connie, who was Elton's kind of PR girl at the time.
Yeah.
And Connie was in a state of advanced terror, as was Kiki D, who was also on the flight.
Yeah.
And Elton was on the plane, everybody else. Yeah. And John Lennon is on the same aircraft.
God, just imagine if that had crashed.
Imagine. So Connie is going berserk.
Yeah.
And Paul said to her, Connie, calm down.
Yeah.
There has never been an air crash this famous. Imagine, no flight is going to go down with both Elton John and John Lennon on the same plane.
Yeah.
Calm down. It's going to be fine.
Mm.
And of course it was.
Yeah.
But imagine, that would have been the plane crash to end all plane
My
crashes.
My God,
it?
Yeah. So if John Lennon hadn't died in the most spectacular but ghastly fashion, being assassinated outside his home, he might have gone down in a plane crash. My God, you get the impression that God wanted him in heaven sooner rather than later, don't you?
Well, this, of course, was well ahead of December 1980 when,
yeah,
John was actually,
yeah,
assassinated.
Yeah.
But it's... Yeah, he was going to go out with a bang one way or another, wasn't
oh,
he?
Yeah.
I hope
oh, yeah,
that's not a crass thing to say.
No, it's not a crass thing to say. How does a man like John Lennon's life end? You're absolutely right. It was always going to be spectacular, whatever happened, but you're so right. Talking about plane crashes, and we don't want to talk about rather maudlin, the other guy who lost his life was the country singer who sang, I'd give up my senses for a night on the ocean or whatever. John Denver.
Oh, John Denver, yeah.
He was flying his own plane. So, again, I'm not laughing, obviously. It's not funny. But
you are laughing, Mr. Parry.
No,
what's going on
no,
here?
I'm just looking back at these things. And,
it's a family show.
It is a family show.
Pull yourself together.
The thinking about that one is that he actually committed suicide and flew his plane into, like, a mountain, you know what I mean? because things weren't, well, obviously things weren't going right at the time. If you suddenly fly your plane into, I don't know why I'm laughing, if you fly your plane into a mountain, it's not a very good idea.
Stop it. Do you know when they used to come around the doors in the old days before we had the internet to do the, was it every 10 years we do the census?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, yeah.
And we'd all stand on the doorstep singing, "You fill up my senses."
I don't know, Miss Joan. Honestly, scraping the barrel there for laughs, I'm telling you.
A little bit, yes.
But I tell you, an amazing plane crash, which I commentated on. How about that? So,
how do you commentate on a plane crash?
I'm going to tell you. So Alan Brazil and I are doing a show, and obviously starts at 6 o'clock in the morning. So over in California, of course, it's 10 o'clock at night, okay? That's right, isn't it? 8 hours back. Yeah, that's it, yeah. So anyway, there's a golfer whose name I can't now remember, but his distinctive look was that he wore plus fours on the golf course, okay? And I'm sorry I can't remember his name, but he was a championship golfer. He'd won a major. And he'd finished in a tournament somewhere in California, right? And his private jet, every golfer's got his own private plane, obviously, because they're mega rich, they're in about $40 million a year or something. And his plane took off from wherever it was in California, and it was heading towards his home, which was in somewhere like, you know, Colorado or something like that, Denver or something like that. Anyway, shortly after takeoff, the control tower of various airports, because these planes are tracked across the air all the time, notices that the plane is not on its proper course. And they tried to get hold of the pilot and they got no communication. So you've now got an aeroplane, a private jet, flying across the United States of America, which is completely out of control and nobody knows why. And there's all speculation that a terrorist had got on board and hijacked the plane and all that. In fact, what happened was, and Brazil and I commentated on this for about 2 hours, right?
Hang on. Wasn't this the one where they had the whole team? There was the whole team and the wives were watching was this another one? Do you remember that one?
I do remember that one. I think that was in South America. No, this one was the United States of America. I wish I could remember the name of the golfer.
No, this one was as well. There was the whole golf team. What's that tournament that they do every year? The one between...
The Ryder Cup.
Yes, it was that one. It was the Ryder Cup team.
Yeah.
All of them were on the same flight.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
And they and all the wives were watching it in absolute terror from home because they knew it was going to end in disaster.
Oh, golly. Well, I have to say, my mind's a blank on that one. But on this one, which I commentated on, what had happened was there was some sort of leak in the heating system or something on the plane and carbon monoxide had got into the plane, killed all the passengers and killed the two pilots, right? So the plane was actually flying with six dead people on board. And it only came down when the fuel ran out and it crashed.
God, that's horrifying.
It is horrifying. So Brazil and I were actually commentating on a plane which was going to crash at some stage, but we didn't know when. And it was, you know, like you say, it was the most strange and eerie sort of story I think I've ever done.
So where did it come down and were loads of people killed when it crashed?
Well, everybody on board is already dead.
Obviously, yeah. Yes, but wherever it came down, did it...
It came down somewhere in the Rocky Mountains or something like
that.
Oh,
okay, okay.
And it took ages to find it, you know what I mean? Because although they know just about where it fell out of the sky, once it comes down under radar, so to speak, it could have gone another 2 or 3 miles, you know, and then smashed to pieces, and it was found over a square footage of about 3 square miles, you know.
How horrible. Yeah. Do you remember when Frank Sinatra's mother died in a plane crash?
No.
Dolly Sinatra, who was an illegal abortionist in New Jersey. Oh, yeah, she had a colourful life.
Wow.
But he was devoted to his mother. Yeah. He worshipped her. And she was in a light aircraft flying to visit him, I think.
Gosh.
And the plane went down and they didn't find it for months.
Right, yeah.
And I think her body was never found.
Golly, that's terrible, isn't it? Shocking.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There we are. Well, that's all a bit more than Miss Jones, but never mind. You know,
On that note,
we light up people's lives. So to everybody...
We fill up their senses.
We fill up their senses. Absolutely right. So to everybody, thank you very much indeed for joining us this week. Back with you next week. Miss Jones, have a fulfilling week ahead and back with you soon. he was a great sort of sociologist in his dealings with the news desk. Whereas most people sort of, you know, just take what the news desk say and act on their orders, Garth would do things like he'd tell them some ridiculous story, right, down the phone, if we were on a job somewhere in a, you know, the remote wilds of where. And then he'd tell them this ridiculous story as to why he had to stay another 2 days, you know, in some location like the Bahamas or something. And then he'd hold the phone away from his ear and pretend he was talking to a colleague by putting his hand over the phone and say, "These bastards don't believe me. They don't know what they're doing, do they? Sitting in their, you know, their ivory towers in London. I'm the guy here who's working myself to death," and all this kind of stuff. And then he put the phone back to his ear and they say, "Oh, all right, Garth, yeah, you better stay a couple of days more." He was flying his own plane. So the, again, I'm not laughing, obviously, it's not funny. But
you are laughing, Mr. Parry. No, what's going on here?
I'm just looking back at these things. And,
it's a family show. Come on, it is a family show. Pull yourself together.
The thinking about that one is that he actually committed suicide and flew his plane into like a mountain, you know what I mean? Because things weren't, well, obviously things weren't going right at the time. If you suddenly fly your plane into, I don't know why I'm laughing, if you fly your plane into a mountain, it's not a very good idea.
Stop it.
And of course, the indomitable. Can't really pronounce that word, actually. yes, I never know whether the N or the M. Honestly, I never know whether the N or the M comes first. Is it indomitable or indomitable?
Indomitable.
Yeah, okay, indomitable. That's great. Thanks very much indeed, Miss Jett. I knew I could rely on you to straighten up my diction.